This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Sheila Dillon, and welcome to this BBC download of the Food Programme. For information on the BBC's terms and conditions of use, visit www.bbc.co.uk/radio4. And now, enjoy the podcast. We're about to enter one of the most tempting corners of the food world.
It's a way we discover about transactions in the world. It's one of the first things that we own. It's got no sort of nutritional content, but I think it's got massive emotional content and massive hedonistic content and pleasure.
Sweets, a food that brings delight and, as we'll hear, dread.
I phoned up my dad and I said, what's this recipe, Dad, that's in here for Riley's? And he went, oh, burn it! Burn it!
In recent years, we've reported from the front lines of the war on sugar. But this week, we're explaining why sweeties haven't been a casualty.
They're promoting harder and they're advertising harder. And I think promotions is a key point we need to make here.
Sugar pie, I'm always thinking about you. Sugar pie, I know there's no one else like you.
Today we're talking about sweets and about the sweets industry, at a time when a lot of scientific, medical and public interest is focused on what sweets are all about, sugar.
Sugar pie, I live in anticipation.
As you'll have heard on this programme over the years, around the world, concerns over the sweet stuff are now changing nutritional advice, government policy and the food industry. Most importantly, it's changing how we eat and drink. Last year saw the first drop ever in sales of smoothies and juices, reflecting our new worries over hidden sugars in our diet. But the real sugary stuff hasn't been taking a hit. Sweet sales are steady, or in some cases, rising steeply. We'll be explaining why that's happening. And this isn't just about the mass market stuff. As I discovered a few weeks ago, going through the nominations for Best Food Producer in the Food and Farming Awards, there's a whole new cottage industry out there of entrepreneurs putting their skills into making high-class sweets, a lot of them tapping into our long, sweet history. One of the stories you told us about was Ella Riley's, a combination sweet shop and sweet maker in Bridge End, South Wales. They were nominated for bringing back to life a sweet that looms large in many people's childhood memories, Riley's Toffee Rolls. So I went to meet the revivers.
Hi, Sweetie, I'm Stephen. How are you?
On the counter were two large glass jars of the famous toffee rolls, first produced in 1907. They have a hand-dipped, rugged chocolate coating and, as I quickly discovered, a deliciously unctuous caramel centre. They're not the loveliest-looking sweets, but they have a history worth telling.
Let's have a look at the book. Looks like a wartime book, doesn't it?
It was. Mm-hmm. And when we first started going through it, it was cutouts of newspapers.
From the Yorkshire Post.
Exactly. There's recipes for salad cream and quite generic. But then, in one of them, was just toffee.
Husband and wife, Stephen Bledsoe and Freya Sykes, together set up and now run Ella Riley's.
Ella Riley was my granny, and it was her uncles who started the original Riley's firm in 1907, so that was my great-great-uncles. And because of that connection, we challenged Kraft, who had the intellectual property rights, and we won. We got it back. I didn't know the full story until it would have been about 2006, 2007. And I'd never really bothered with the recipe book. And one sort of Easter, the children were playing up, and I thought, right, we'll get the recipe book down. And I found this recipe in there for Riley's. I phoned up my dad and I said, what's this recipe, Dad, that's in here for Riley's? And he went, oh, burn it! Burn it! Get rid of it! Don't do anything with it! Throw it on the fire! And my dad is the most placid chap you're ever going to meet. And I was shocked, genuinely shocked. And I said, why on earth would I burn this? And he went, I've got no blooming teeth because of that thing. And apparently he was the chief toffee taster as a child. And he blames his lack of teeth on the toffee.
When had Kraft bought it?
There was a succession of buyouts in the 80s, was it,
when they acquired Callard and Bowser. They actually secured Riley's. It was one of those multi-company purchases. They didn't realise they were buying it.
So, I can't read the recipe because it's a secret. But
there's nothing healthy in there.
Well, there's some milk, even if it's tinned. That's amazing. So, you had to experiment with that.
What had happened over the years, though, and it always happens when a company takes over another company, they try to make good on their investment, don't they? And one of the ways to do that is to slice the ingredients and put something cheaper in or pad it out and put fillers in. So over time, it had sort of manoeuvred away from the original recipe. But obviously, having the original handwritten recipe, we were able to take it right back to the original. And it's got a fantastic flavour.
So you find the recipe, you experiment. You know, the world has been taken over by...
Absolutely.
I mean, Callard and Bowser doesn't exist anymore. Completely. Terry's is gone and Cadbury's bought up by Kraft and now by somebody else. What made you think that this could be a business that would give you a living?
I think it was a moment of madness. I really genuinely do. What happened was, I mean, we gave it to some friends and they sort of said, oh, yes, that's very nice, that is. From there, we sort of gave it to other people that we didn't know, and they said the same thing, and we thought, aye, hang on. And that's literally all it was. It just started as, yeah, go on, we'll give it a try. And it's snowballed. We don't import them from Europe and, you know, sell them on as similar to such and such sweet, you know, as some shops do. You get a proper British sweet with a heritage when you buy from us.
There's a big weight of responsibility on our shoulders because we're messing around with people's memories, so we have to make sure that we're making a really, really good sweet.
It's a short journey from the fantastical sweet shop lined with glass jars full of temptation to the manufacturing heart of Ella Riley's. Five steps away is a small kitchen at the back of the shop.
Those are copper bottom pans that every slab of Riley's toffee roll is made in. Each batch makes around about 2 kilograms of Riley's toffee. Each batch takes me around about 15 minutes to make. And I've got to make 52 batches by the end of this week.
A mad idea turned into a good business idea. How are you doing now in Bridge End?
We're currently supplying around about 160 traditional sweet shops in the UK. We are in America. We're hoping to go into Canada. We're close to buying a toffee boiler to try and increase the output. At the moment, they're still all handmade. It's just a case of adding an extra half an hour to every working day at the moment.
The United States, well, not North America, because you're trying to get into Canada now. What made you think that would be a good market?
We sent over a free sample to a podcast that's hosted by the NFL, the American Football League. They were doing a taste test of some British crisps. So I sent them a tweet and said, if you want to taste some proper British goodies, I'll send you some Riley's toffee rolls. So we send them out a box. It was taste tested live on their podcast on Super Bowl weekend. I know in the radio world you don't like dead air, but there was about 90 seconds of five grown men going, The inquiries went through the roof.
Ella Riley's. The toffee rolls were originally made in Halifax in Yorkshire. The industrial areas of the UK have a particularly rich sweet history. Sweets are very regional and tell us a lot about our history, as I learned from Tim Richardson.
I call myself, slightly tongue-in-cheek, the world's first international confectionery historian.
Tim is the author of Sweets, The History of Temptation.
And they're quite an interesting kind of prism, a way of looking at different cultures and the way they, particularly the way those cultures intersected.
There is a thrill, isn't there, in walking into an old-fashioned sweet shop?
I think it is the excitement bound up with knowing that you have so much choice, you know, and that all of those sweets have their own particular flavour and texture. And it's not just in the sweet shops, but if you just go into a normal shop, like a normal newsagent, the average rack of sweets, you know, next to the cash till, is probably, what is it, about 10 feet by 3 feet or something, and it's crammed with sweets. And every single British person going in kind of knows what every single one of those sweets tastes like. And that doesn't happen anywhere else in the world, to be honest, because we are like sweets connoisseurs, really, without knowing it.
Tim brought along a large bag of sweets to our interview, and we'll be dipping into it as we go through the programme to help explain why history is everything in our sweetie story.
Pineapple cubes.
So this beautiful little cube, a yellow cube, is a pineapple cube glistening with its sugar. And of course, it's an imitation of a real pineapple cube. Fruits were imported from the Middle East and coated in sugar in order to preserve them. In the 18th century, if you went to a confectioner's, you'd see this bulging bow window and filled with glacé fruits and jellies and pastels, very beautiful, and they were quite expensive. Sugarcane grows like Billy O on the Caribbean, and they decided that that was the crop which was going to be grown as part of this, you know, heinous slave system. So that's the sort of bitter tinge of sweetness, of course, all the way through. And the idea originally was that all of the sugar would be refined in, you know, Liverpool and London, and then be re-exported across Europe and the rest of the world. In the event, really, the British ate all of the sugar, though, and ever-increasing quantities. It became a little cottage industry for people to start making imitations of those expensive sweets, particularly in the port towns of Bristol and Liverpool and Greenock near Glasgow. The sweetie wives, as they were called, would go buy some sugar from the docks, stir it up in a copper pan with water and flavouring, and then sell these imitation sweets like lemon sherbets and things like pineapple cubes. It's an imitation of a medieval sweetmeat. God, that's brave to bite into a pineapple cube.
Well, my molars survived. Pineapple cubes aren't big sellers today, but they are a resilient part of an extremely resilient industry. Rob Brown is the category reports editor for The Grocer magazine.
You might be surprised to hear, Sheila, that the sugar confectionery market over the past year has seemed quite resilient. It's big business for the supermarkets. It's worth about £1.2 billion a year. It's been holding up pretty well for the last few years. I think that's the key point, and that's down to a number of factors. I mean, obviously, we keep reading, and at The Grocer we're writing about the war on sugar every day. But despite this, confectioners have responded in a number of ways. They've been promoting more, they've been spending a lot more on advertising, and they've been bringing out more and more different varieties of sweets.
And that promotion seems to be protecting them from a sales hit that's affecting a lot of other foods.
So far, the war on sugar has very much been focused on products that in the past have been marketed as healthier, so things like fruit juice, smoothies and so on. And perhaps rightly so, given that not so long ago these products were marketed as something you should consume quite a large volume of every day for breakfast, whereas sweets and chocolate and biscuits and things like that have actually been marketed, and I think perceived by consumers, to be treats or permissible treats.
Well, who are the big players now in the UK?
Haribo is number one. It's worth about £170 million, and it's in not bad growth given its size. It's up about 3% in the past year, and volumes are up just under 1% as well. They've been bringing out lots of licensed products, you know, to tie up with films such as Despicable Me. Zing, spending a lot more on advertising.
That film tie-in using Minions, those monsters from Despicable Me, is just one part of a bigger promotions push.
Mars is obviously a big player. They've got Skittles, which has seen quite significant growth over the past year. That's down to bringing out more products. They're promoting harder and they're advertising harder. And I think promotions is a key point we need to make here. There's been a lot of press around Tesco and other retailers removing sugar, confectionery and chocolate from their checkouts, the end of the so-called guilt lane. But actually, the data that we've been looking at recently, what's followed on from this removal of sweets from the checkouts is brands being very shrewd and paying to have their products placed at other prominent parts in store. Featured space promotions, that's what the retailers would call it, have actually increased on confectionery over the past year. And that's because confectionery brands, having been removed from the tills, are paying to go on sort of main thoroughfares through the supermarkets so that they're seen by shoppers and they end up in the shopping baskets.
And sweet promotions on supermarket web pages as people order for home delivery are also making an impact. Online confectionery sales are now growing faster than any other part of the grocery market. A new trend in a long-running story. Back to Tim's Bag of Sweets.
Love Hearts are an example of what's called in the trade a pressed tablet sweet. A lot of sweets look like pills, don't they? Actually, if you go to, let's say leading chemists today, you will find sweets on the counter, which is a bit bizarre, isn't it, if you think about it? So really the same machines that we use for making pills were used for making these. And a really interesting example of that, do you know what a flying saucer is?
Flying saucers.
The machine that made that was a sort of press thing, which, pulled down and you put your medicine in the rice paper. That was how medicines were dispensed. And then with Love Hearts, we have the additional thing of the message on them, of course, a very mysterious message.
Which Dear I never, one.
There were some real kind of crazies for this in the Victorian period. The weirdest one I came across was an example of a sweet which had the phrase, "Do you love Sprats?" written on it.
Well, the company that makes those Love Hearts, though sadly not promoting Sprats, is a major player in the UK with about 10% of the market, and they're growing.
I'm Jeremy Dee. I'm the managing director of Swizzles Matlow. Over the last 2 years, we've actually grown the business by about 14%. So clearly, a lot of that was the year prior to last, but we still saw growth last year as well.
Jeremy is the third generation of his family to run the business. His grandfather, with compressed tablet-making experience, joined forces with the Matlow brothers in 1933.
We turned over 2014 in excess of 60 million. We're the largest UK-owned and family-independent sugar confectionery company, and that's something we're really proud of.
So how many sweets are you producing now?
We make in the UK over 250 lines. And if you take into account our export business as well, then it's probably over 400 lines in total.
But how have you adapted to changing tastes over the years?
I mean, we've certainly noticed that a change in preferences, probably in textures over the year, and in particular the rise of popularity of gums and jellies. And so that was very much behind the launch of our squashes range, where we've taken our classic brands like drumsticks and refreshers and we've transformed them into a jelly or foam version. But having said that, a lot of the feedback that we get is that the products taste exactly as people remember them from all those years ago. So we really take great care in preserving the taste of the products so that they are as people remember them.
So what are the future plans?
We set out an ambitious plan a couple of years ago, and that was to double the size of the business by 2020.
But your plan is going to be carried out against a background of a very serious debate about sugar.
We welcome the debate around hidden sugars, but confectionery is a treat, and it's a treat to be enjoyed in moderation. And, it's not really not pretending to be anything else. So I think to that end, there probably needs to be a bit of balance on that issue. Sweets have been part of the landscape and celebratory and enjoyable thing for many, many years.
Looking for some sweeties.
What about some Love Hearts?
Yeah.
It's a nostalgia that's bringing in the lolly. Retro Suite sales are up, and a lot of them are now sold in the new but traditional style suite shops. Just like Ella Riley's in Bridge End, they're packed floor to ceiling with jars of many coloured sweets.
My name is Christine O'Kay and I manage the Whitstable Sugar Boy. How would I describe it? Kind of everybody's dream shop of all ages. You know, anybody that comes in, they always have that, oh, wow, it's chock-a-block full of sweets. Do you want me to show you 100 grams or...
It's the taste of childhood that keeps people coming back.
I've eaten these since I was a little boy. So that's why I buy fruit pastels.
Everyone loves the sweet and it's nostalgia.
We come after school sometimes, don't we, for a special treat?
A happy face and a lollipop. I don't know what that is.
Marshmallows.
The marshmallow is a plant. This one is Althea officinalis, which has pink flowers. So nearly all of these sweets which we're talking about were perceived to have a medicinal function. So the marshmallow, the stuff which was used as a thickener, is from the roots. It's a sticky sort of sap that comes out of the roots. Now I think that marshmallows are pink and white in our bags because of that's a reference to the whiteness of the sticky root stuff and to the pink flower. You know, of course, marshmallow isn't made from marshmallow anymore, but when it was, you know, it was used for things. Stomach disorders, I remember, and as a diuretic, and people with various infections of the kidneys used to be given this. And so it was often a case of just sweetening the pill.
So we're going to boil this mixture up to something that's called hard ball.
Adele Nozidar has been a musician, then a forager, an expert on wild plants, and through that became intrigued by how lots of those plants had been used over the centuries in sweets, like the marshmallow Tim was just talking about. Now she's one of a new group teaching us do-it-yourself sweet making, and she's written a book about our regional sweet history with recipes, Great British Sweets. She joined us in the Ella Riley kitchen.
I realise that it's only a really short step away from edible wild plants, especially ones that are used such for herbal remedies such as licorice and mint. Once you add sugar, they become confectionery. Licorice is a really good case in point. As a medicine, we know it was used in the pyramids, and it took, I think he must have been a 15, 16-year-old boy, George Dunhill, the son of a chemist in Pontefract, who added sugar to his medicine, but actually he found that he made something that was so delicious that Pontefract is, you say Pontefract, and you immediately think Pontefract cake, became totally synonymous with the town. Licorice, as a plant, was so valuable in Pontefract that if you left the town with some of it, with the intention of growing it outside the city walls, or, God forbid, selling it, you could be put to death.
So, okay, what are you going to make?
I'm going to make humbugs.
Humbugs?
You know, towns all around Britain seem to have their version of a stripy mint. If you think of Everton mints, it's a humbug. Jethet balls. There's a thing here about humbugs, about the origin of the words. And it's
I see
mysteries.
From a Gaskell novel, Sylvia's Lovers. Look at the way she spells toffee. T-O-F-F-Y.
The rattling sound is me opening
up. Yeah, so we're opening the sugar, so you've got sugar. Granulated white sugar. It's a lesson in what sweets are if you watch somebody make them, isn't it?
Do you know what? It made me want people to think a bit more about the amount of sugar in their diets. If sugar's a treat and if sweets are a treat the way they used to be, then there's a very different approach to them than if you can just go and buy, you know, three bags of sweets from a supermarket, which is a fairly joyless exchange, I think.
So you've put in... What was that? Cream of tartar? Water, sugar, cream of tartar.
Water and sugar. And so we're going to cook this very slowly so that the sugar melts properly.
You are a forager, really. You're interested in plants. Tell me about how you got from one to the other.
It's about stories, really. I went off with my best friend in her car and we just went on kind of a Thelma and Louise style road trip, except without the nasty ending and loads of sweets along the way. But I went to see...
So no drink, no men, just sweets.
Why do you need drink and men if you've got, you know, humbugs? They're starting to fizzle a bit now.
The recipes, did you get them from the manufacturers
Some of them I did. The guys at Romney's
Kendall mint cake were just brilliant because they've been using the same copper pots for the last 200 years. I was trying to say, if I was going to make these at home, how would I go about it? He said, do you just want the recipe? And I said, yeah, that would be really great.
So now that it's reached the hardball stage...
It's mint because otherwise, which is a proper mince made from real mint.
Why do you need food colouring? Because of the
humbugs.
So what would they have used in, I don't know, the 19th century?
A good question. It probably would be illegal now because they had all sorts of ingredients like arsenic and lead. We probably had an awful lot of people frothing at the mouth, you know, with whatever was going in them at the time.
That's marvellous, the green getting stirred in.
If you're making this with kids, provided you get it to this point, it's just like slightly warm plasticine. A lot of fun.
Okay, I'm eating a warm humbug. It might have funny green colour, but very nice tasting.
We are currently ripping open a sherbet dib dab.
So what does that tell us?
Sherbet is, you know, one of the most evocative of all sweets. You know, it's a fabulous Arabian drink, actually, sherbet. Absolutely lovely. Now, the sherbet which we have, our powder, our mysterious powder, which you're dib-dabbing away now, it's brilliant, isn't it, though, that mix of the sherbet dip and the lollipop. You're sort of in complete control of your sherbet dip, and you can eat it, things in different ways. You know, do you immediately, you know, bite into your sherbet lemon like a kind of kamikaze sweet eater, devil may care, and just deal with it, you know, that incredible explosion of sherbet? Or are you a more timid one who sort of tries to suck the aniseed ball right down until you can literally feel the aniseed on your tongue? What we do with sweets is completely unprecedented, isn't it? If you have a lollipop, what other foodstuff do you put in your mouth? And it's acceptable in semi-polite company to take it out again and then discuss sort of where you're at with your traffic light. You kind of examine it. You say to the person next to you, look at that. Look at that, I've nearly got all the yellow off there. There's a bit of red left, and the green is non-existent. You know, every sweet is its own little journey.
Which is a charming way to describe our very British sweetie eating habits. But surely there's something a bit odd about so many of our national memories being embedded in sugar. And as we've heard in this programme, there's no sign of that habit fading away. Or, as I put it to Tim Richardson after I'd tasted almost everything in his sweetie collection,
do you feel your interest is rather under attack now as sugar is the new demon in our diet?
It frustrates me a little bit. When I embarked on researching and writing the book as a journalist, you know, in my day job, I realised that a better story, if you like, would be to do a big expose of the sweets and confectionery industry. I didn't embark to write that book. I really embarked on the book because I like sweets, and I found the whole topic really interesting, as you said earlier, as a prism, a way of looking at history. You know, sugar confectionery is pretty much pure sugar, whatever you think of that. You know, people, it's got no sort of nutritional content. But I think it's got massive emotional content. It also is not, in that form, as egregious as it can be in the way it's used in these other foodstuffs. So I'm just trying to separate it, I suppose. I think that we should give sweets in moderation to children as joyous gifts with, you know, love in our eyes and enjoy the pleasure with them. Let them own their own sweets. It's important for children to own and buy sweets and to give sweets and receive them and borrow them. It's a way we discover about transactions in the world. It's one of the first things that we own.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive? And your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.